Purim is a very, very unique book of the Bible because it is an event that occurred totally outside of the land of Israel. And the basic idea was that if you read the book of Malachim, the book of Kings, so the book of Kings ends, quite logically, with the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, the destruction of the temple that King Solomon built. And just in terms of numbers, how many years, right? The Jews were in the desert for 40 years, and they came to the land of Israel. And we had the period of the judges, and then we had the period of the kings, and then we had the splitting of the two kingdoms, right? Remember the 10 tribes split from the two tribes, and there were actually two different kingdoms. Judah and Israel. Basically, what happened was that the southern kingdom was called the kingdom of Yehuda, the kingdom of Judah, and that only had two tribes, Yehuda and Binyamin, and it was centered around Yerushalayim and somewhat south around Beis Lechem. And really, most of the Kohanim were here too, because this is where they had their job. But 10 whole tribes separated and established a northern kingdom, which is called the Kingdom of Israel, Malchus Yisrael. And there were even times in which there were civil wars between these two different nations. So just in terms of getting a sense of overall history as a preliminary to the book of Esther, how many years were the Jews in their land until there was the destruction of the temple? So we can actually show that they were in the land for 850 years, quite a long time. How do we know that? We know that really from two numbers. One is a number that is recorded in the book of Kings, that Solomon built the temple 480 years after the Jews left Egypt. Now, since we know that they wandered in the desert for 40 years, then essentially he built the temple 440 years after they came to the land. So it's 440 before the temple, and we have another number that the temple stood for 410 years. So 440 plus 410 is a total of 850 years, right? So from the time of Yehoshua, till the time of the destruction of the temple was, in fact, 850 years. Yeah.
Question, does it say he began building the temple or he finished building the temple at the end of
the
temple?
The implication seems to be that the temple was finished. That's correct. Yeah. The implication was that the temple was completed.
We know how long it took to complete the temple.
Yes, we do, because it indicates what year of his reign it started, and it indicated what year of his reign it finished.
So, worst case scenario, we know the exact amount.
And obviously it would make a difference in the 850, but not by a big factor. It would make a difference of around 7 years, because it was a seven-year construction project. By the way, we don't know exactly how the Solomon Temple worked. When you see the great pictures of, or at least the estimates or guesstimates, I mean, no one has a picture, of the temple, that is the Herodian Temple. That was the second temple in its waning years that Herod constructed. We don't really know how the Temple of Solomon looked, although structurally it certainly had to have the same basic components, you know, the altar, the courtyards, the Holy of Holies. I mean, the structural elements were the same, but the porticos and the like were really Roman architecture, so we really don't exactly know what it looked like. Okay, but it was said to be a magnificent building as well. Now, here is the thing. So we have this 850-year period. But the 850-year period has many, many subdivisions. First of all, we have Joshua and the judges, meaning to say for around 300 years, there was no centralized king. Rather, everybody was doing, in fact, as the book of Judges says, every person lived under his fig tree and vine, and each person did what he wanted to do. Now, that could be said as an anarchist would love that, but on the other hand, it's also usually in the book of Judges, it indicates kind of a social breakdown, and whenever they were attacked by enemies, they would get a judge. So actually, the word judge is a bit of a misnomer, because we look at a judge as somebody who resolves disputes. In the book of Judges, judges were primarily military leaders. It's an unusual term for the term judges. But they were not kings, because each tribe was like a separate nation. Now, eventually, in the time of the prophet Shmuel, the prophet Samuel, the Jewish people did ask for a king. And Samuel was not satisfied. Samuel actually said that Hashem was not happy with that decision, because the idea was seeking a human king was a rebellion against Hashem. And as you know, the first king was Saul, Shaul. And Shaul was essentially removed from office by God because Shaul did not carry out his obligation to eradicate Amalek. And as you mentioned yesterday, that had cosmic repercussions, because although Shmuel eventually killed the Amalekite king, but in the interim, there was a woman who got impregnated, and she was not found or identified, and eventually her descendant was none other than Haman. And Mordechai and Esther are the descendants of Shaul, and cosmically, they have to play the role in the destruction of Haman. So that inaugurates the period of the king. So Saul from the tribe of Benjamin was the first king, and then the line went over to David from the tribe of Yehuda. And David was followed by King Solomon. Shaul, David, and Shlomo are the only three kings who ruled over an entire Jewish nation. Because after Shlomo died and it was succeeded by his son, Rechavam, there was then a split. There was then a civil war in which 10 tribes abandoned their allegiance to the Malchus of David. So that meant that the Davidic line, which did continue until the destruction of the temple, the Davidic line had the Beis HaMikdash, which was of course a big important thing, and Yerushalayim, but not much more. The majority of the population and a majority of the land of the boundaries of Israel was the kingdom of the 10 tribes. So from then on, we're dealing with two parallel roads in the book of Kings. We have the story of the kings of Yehuda, we have the story of the kings of Israel, and their paths often cross in terms of wars, skirmishes, foreign affiliation, and the like. Now, what eventually happened was that the kingdom of Assyria, vanquished, destroyed the northern kingdom more than 100 years before the destruction of the temple. So in the last 120 years or so, the 10 tribes were not around. Now, that's why we get the story called the Lost 10 Tribes. Now, it's a bit of a misnomer because, for example, let's look at ourselves, right? We're Jews. So some people say, well, gee, if the 10 tribes were lost, exiled, we don't know where they are. You know, some people thought the American Indians were descended from the lost 10 tribes. Some people think even some of the Ethiopian Jews are descended, right? All sorts of situations.
Well, do I believe that they're from like Ephraim and Manasseh?
Well, they traditionally say they're from the tribe of Dan. That was their own self-identification. There is a theory that millions of Pashtuns, which is the largest tribe in Afghanistan, have some evidence of Jewish blood, perhaps from the so-called lost 10 tribes, and even the Vikings, the old Vikings of Norse conquest, were identified. So everyone looks, you find the lost 10 tribes everywhere, but there's a bit of a fallacy in that, although everything is possible, and that is the prophet never makes the claim that every single member of the 10 tribes was lost and intermingled. It means the kingdom was destroyed. But remember that even in those days, there was a certain amount of immigration, meaning in the tribe, in the Malchus of Yehuda, there were Jews from all tribes. So any one of us, you could be from a Reuven. You don't have to be Yehuda, Binyamin, or a Kohen, or a Levi. You could be from Reuven, Yisachar, Zevulun. You could be a remnant of the 10 tribes that found their way back, right? So really it was the kingdom that was destroyed and much of the population exiled, but nevertheless there were individual Jews from all of the tribes who remained with Malchus Yehuda. So basically the 10 tribes kingdom was destroyed and exiled 110 or 20 years before the destruction of the temple.
Do you have any idea of the percent of the population from that kingdom that disappeared?
Well, it was significant. I don't really have a clear population figure. My point simply was it was never 100%.
Of course.
Meaning there were remnants. So any Jew who's identifying himself as a Jew could theoretically be from any one of the tribes. Now, the king of Assyria, who vanquished the 10 tribes, was one of the world's great conquerors. That was Sennacherib, the king of Ashur. And he indeed has monuments that we have to this very day in which he boasts of his greatness in vanquishing the Jewish people of the 10 tribes of Israel. But after he did that, he obviously turned his army south to Jerusalem to vanquish the Judean kingdom. Yeah. Say again? Oh, you saw them? Okay. Yeah. Well, that's very good. I should look at them myself because not again, as a believing Jew, we don't believe that the Bible needs corroboration, but it's still interesting to see that indeed the very events reported in the Bible
It could simply be someone with the same name.
Right.
But there was a royal seal belonging to Jezebel.
Wow.
That's
infamous. You know, Jezebel was a real bad character.
The seal that said it belonged to Haman. I'm not sure whether or not it belonged to the Haman.
Yeah, what's Haman's seal doing in Israel? So, okay.
Taking as a souvenir.
Yeah, man, right. Yeah. Could be like Saddam Hussein's pistol or whatever.
Those ones, and there's actual reference to a lot of famous biblical things.
Yeah, it is interesting. Now, again, in all honesty, there's a lot of things that archaeology does not corroborate. For example, the Exodus, although you'll hear a lecture on it, I think. The Exodus, there's not a tremendous amount of archaeological evidence. There's some, but it's kind of a bald spot.
There is evidence that they from somewhere else in Israel.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but again, certainly not the numbers of 3 million or whatever. Well, that's for sure. That's for sure. But when it comes to the period of the kings, the archaeological evidence is very, very rich and corroborating, which is I guess it's always comforting in that way. Now, here's the thing. So Sancheirov then turned his great army southward. And indeed, he decimated much of the kingdom of Yehuda. Much of it got destroyed. But when he came to Jerusalem, the Book of Kings records a very, very great miracle that on the eve of what should have been his conquest and destruction of the city of Jerusalem, a plague smote his soldiers and 180,000 soldiers died. Sancheirov survived to hobble back to Assyria, where he was killed. Right, Nebuchadnezzar was a young private in Sancheirov's army, the one who later became king of Babylonia. And according to tradition, although this is not recorded, that great miracle happened the first night of Passover. So you'll notice this. If you have a Haggadah with a translation, at the end of the Seder, we sing these different songs, what happened at midnight, all the different things that happened at midnight. So you'll notice there will be references to the downfall of Sancheirov's army at midnight. And this was a remarkable thing. Many Jews thought that this was the coming of Mashiach. This was the final redemption. It was really a supernatural miracle that Sancheirov's army would be wiped out instantaneously in this particular way. And indeed, Chazal teach us that had the Jewish people been worthy of that moment, that could have turned into a messianic moment. So on one hand, it's kind of a tragedy. The 10 tribes were decimated. On the other hand, Yerushalayim and the temple was miraculously spared. But without getting into all of the details, it hobbled along for another 100 years and in not such good shape. The kings were not that righteous most of the time. And there was Avodah Zarah, and there were other sins. And eventually what happened was the new empire, the Chaldean Empire of Babylonia, Babylonia is where modern-day Iraq is, eventually became the dominant power in the world, first vanquishing Assyria, and then Egypt, and then, of course, as a cleanup, to conquer the land of Israel. So, and of course, the king of Babylonia during this critical period was the fellow that we know as Nebuchadnezzar. And here is the interesting point. The conquest of Malchus Yehuda, of Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, actually took place in three stages. And this is going to be important because it'll tie into the historical background of Megillas Esther. Stage number one was simply the conquest of the land of Judah, making it a vassal state that had to pay tributary. So there was no destruction of the temple, and there was no exile of the population. It simply was conquering. The Jews still had a king, but that king was a vassal king. He was subservient to Babylon and had to pay tribute. So we'll call that stage one of what culminated in the Churban. That was simply the conquest of Judah, making it a subservient state.
What is Churban?
Oh, I'm sorry. Churban is destruction.
Okay.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is the what eventually culminated in the destruction of the temple actually took place in three stages. Stage one was the conquest. All three, by the way, happened under Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the guy in all three of these stages. Stage one was the conquest of the Judean state, in which the Jews still had a king. They still had a king, but the king was a vassal and had to pay tribute and owed allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar. Okay. Stage two was 7 years later. 7 years later, there was a significant wave of people that Nebuchadnezzar considered to be potentially revolutionary that he physically removed from the land and sent them into exile into different countries, particularly Babylonia itself. Now, these people, so we'll call this the first wave of exiles, 7 years later. These people are described in the Book of Kings by an unusual appellation in Hebrew. They're called the Charash and the Masker. Now, Charash and Masker literally means the carpenters and the locksmiths. So it might sound like a kind of a strange population to pick on, but he removed from the land of Israel the carpenters and the locksmiths. But this is understood literally to simply mean he removed skilled artisans who would be capable of fashioning weapons. Right? Locksmiths, carpenters. In other words, he wanted to remove any potential for armed resistance. By the way, this is what, without getting into politics, this is what the gun lobby always says. The gun lobby says that governments that try to ban firearms is really the first step towards oppression. They want to remove from the citizenry any ability to defend themselves. So Nebuchadnezzar essentially was kind of taking extreme gun, the equivalent of extreme gun control measures, removing anyone that would be capable of fashioning. Now, this is the simple meaning of it. But there's an interesting rabbinic teaching that Charash and Masker is a term for the learned, educated classes who are Talmidei Chachamim and rabbis. He took the Torah scholars out of the land of Israel. Now, from his perspective, what was the purpose of that? Perhaps because he felt that they could provide leadership to the Jewish and he didn't want them to have their leaders. But from God's perspective, it is said that God wanted a Torah leadership to be reestablished in Babylonia so that when everybody else joins, there's already going to be a Torah educational network. So Nebuchadnezzar had one thing in mind, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, the Almighty, had another thing in mind. So this is the first wave of exile, and this occurred during the reign of King Jehoiachin. He was the Jewish king at the time. Now, 11 years later was Nebuchadnezzar's final foray in which some Jews tried to rebel. He destroyed the temple and he exiled. He emptied out the land. Basically, nobody was left. He simply transposed. In the ancient world, this was a common... In fact, Sennacherib, the Assyrian guy, is said to have invented this. The notion that when you vanquish a population, you transpose populations. You move people into different countries. This idea of exile. And part of it was psychological, that when you're in a new unfamiliar place, you're not really oriented very well. You can't really get your life together that much, and therefore you're not capable of... You don't know where to hide, you don't know how to do things, etc. You don't know your way around. So that way he felt that created security. So, I'm going to give
was
you...
Was this whole thing part of his plan, the whole 9-year, 7-year, whatever period?
Well, it seems not. It seems that he was responding to potential rebelliousness on the part of the Jews, and therefore he was getting successively more strict as time was going on. Okay? So, I don't want to overwhelm you with chronology or dates, but if you can follow just the three stages here, this would be very, very helpful. You'll really see the Megillah historically in a way that you probably never saw it before. And that is, we start off with Nebuchadnezzar's conquest of the lands. And here, this was during the reign of Jehoiakim. Now, I'm going to warn you, these kings are going to sound a lot alike. So that's called the conquest of Jehoiakim. Of meaning, not that he was the conqueror, but he was the conquered. The conquest of Jehoiakim. 7 years later, the first wave of exiles of the learned, educated Talmidei Chachamim, scholars of Torah class, and that was under the vassal reign of Jehoiakim's son, Jehoiachin. So that's called the exile of Jehoiachin. Okay. Now, 11 years later, now for the next 11 years, the Jews are still, at least the less educated classes, the less skilled classes are still hanging in there. Under the reign of the last king of Judea, who's called Sidkiyahu. And after 11 years, Sidkiyahu was murdered. And I'll describe that in some detail. The Chorban, the temple, was destroyed. And the Jews were exiled from the land. And that, of course, happened on the 9th of Av, the destruction of the first temple. Now, this last king of Judah is an interesting fellow. This is Sidkiyahu. If you did a little touring around the outside of the old city, you know, did you come across Sidkiyahu's cave, Ma'arat Sidkiyahu? So here's the story. Sidkiyahu also had to take an oath of allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar, but at some point he attempted a rebellion. And the prophet who was in Israel at the time, in Jerusalem at the time, was none other than the prophet Jeremiah. He was the prophet at the time. And interestingly enough, there were many, many false prophets. And what's fascinating is, the false prophets were giving the Jews the message, hey, you guys have the temple, God loves the Jewish people, we're the chosen people. We can certainly fight against the Babylonians, we will be victorious. They're giving the message of hope, optimism, and courage. But it's all fake, because the Jews are not deserving of God helping them. They have sinned. Jeremiah is giving the message, don't fight. If you fight, there'll be a catastrophe. If you rebel, you'll lose everything. Jeremiah was a pacifist. Jeremiah was someone telling the Jews, remain subservient to Babylon, and you will be able to stay in your land and keep your temple. But if you rebel, God is not going to listen to you. Now, what's so interesting is that in the eyes of many, many Jews, Jeremiah was considered what we would call an appeaser, like Neville Chamberlain, right? Kind of, you know, give the enemy, you know, whatever he wants. Or the term they use sometimes is quisling. That's just a term because there was a Norwegian Nazi collaborator whose name was Quisling and whatever. So quisling is a term we sometimes use for people who are appeasing, right? So Jeremiah was accused of being a false prophet. His life was threatened, and he was actually lowered into a pit. That was the prison cells in those days. They didn't have cable TV and air conditioning, like the federal prisons. And he would have died in that pit. But it mentions that there was a slave that had mercy on him, a very righteous slave. In fact, according to some traditions, he was a black slave, but he had become a Jew. Interesting. And he had lifted him out of the pit. So Jeremiah himself was very persecuted. But nevertheless, everything he said came to pass. And he told Sidkiyahu the following prophecy. Listen, this is amazing. He told Sidkiyahu, do not rebel against Nebuchadnezzar, because if you do, you shall be brought to Bavel. You shall die in Bavel. But your eyes shall never see Bavel. Now this made no literal sense. But here is what happened. When Nebuchadnezzar finally declared final war because of the potential rebellion, Sidkiyahu attempted to escape. And just like, you know, presidents have all of these secret tunnels under the White House and everything, Sidkiyahu had a tunnel running under the whole length of the old city, which he could enter from his palace. And that would take him some distance from the old city. And he was on that tunnel, and he would have escaped. And God, Nebuchadnezzar liked to hunt in his spare time, and God made a deer come out of nowhere that Nebuchadnezzar was chasing in the direction of Sidkiyahu's emergence from the cave. So exactly at the moment Sidkiyahu came out of the cave, Nebuchadnezzar was there with his soldiers. So Sidkiyahu was captured. He was brought to Babylonia. I'm sorry. Before he was brought to Babylonia, what happened was that Nebuchadnezzar slaughtered his children in his presence. So he would see the deaths of his children. He then poked out his eyes. He blinded him. So his last memory would be seeing the death of his children. Then he was brought to Babylon as a trophy of war, and he was killed. Now, look how amazingly the prophecy was kept. You will be brought to Babylon. You will die in Babylon. Your eyes will never see Babylon. Exactly what happened. And Zedekiah was the last king of the Davidic line who was killed. Now, you may say, so where's Mashiach going to come from? Well, the short answer is that some of the earlier kings did have progeny that did survive. They never became kings. Jehoiachin, for example, had a son who survived, and Mashiach will be descended from.
Were the kings just the firstborn of the?
Generally, most of the time. Most of the time, they were the firstborn, but there was a hereditary succession. For the Israelite kingdom, there tended to be many more coups, so you very rarely had more than two or three generations until you got somebody else. But the Judean kings were really son after son after son, with only very, very brief interludes of sometimes somebody else stepped in. And the like. Okay, now let me point out this. Even after the destruction of the temple and the exile of the overwhelming population, Nebuchadnezzar still permitted a very small group of poor farmers to remain in their patches. And he even appointed them a governor. And that governor's name was Gedaliah, a Jewish man, a Jewish governor. Gedaliah, however, was assassinated by some political enemies around 7 months later, and we celebrate, I'm sorry, not 7 months later, 3 months later. Right? The fast of Gedaliah, there's a fast, right? The day after Rosh Hashanah, we have a fast to commemorate the assassination of Gedaliah. So the temple was destroyed on the 9th of Av, and the fast of Gedaliah is the 3rd of Tishrei. Well, that's less than 2 months later, right? 9th of Av, so Elul, Tishrei, right? So essentially, therefore, the death of Gedaliah was the nail in the coffin, right? The Chorban, the destruction of the temple, and the death of Gedaliah, and that was it. That was there was no Jewish presence in Eretz Yisrael for the next 52 years. Okay, remember that, 52 years. Now, was there any Jew in Israel? You know, maybe somebody was hiding out. I mean, I just read about a family in Russia that was in such an isolated place. I mean, that they had been there since 1930s because they were fleeing religious persecution. They did not even know there was a World War II. They didn't even know.
Have to be like in the ground.
It's kind of amazing. So, you know, could there have been a Jew somewhere? You know, maybe, yeah. In fact, I believe there are some there's like one family in Tekoa that claims an unbroken presence, pretty amazing, in the land of Israel, even from before the destruction of the first temple, meaning they claim that they didn't leave. Okay, but by and large, there was nothing here. Now, I have to go further again. All of this is prehistory to Megillas Esther. Okay, now the Jews are in Babel. By the way, Jeremiah gave them another message too. Jeremiah says that when you go to Babylon, although you mourn Jerusalem and you pray to God, but don't withdraw. Try to be productive, constructive citizens in the land that you live in. Build houses, plant trees, cultivate fields. This is the source of the idea that a Jew is supposed to obey the law of the land that they're in. And this is even the source of the idea that we pray for the welfare of the government. Right? Many synagogues have a prayer. Right. But they also pray on Shabbos. We pray for Israel. Not everybody, but in Siddurim we have a prayer for the state of Israel, and we also have a prayer for the, if United States or England or whatever country you're in. And that's based in Jeremiah's words, that the Jew cannot just give up on life, but wherever you are, you have to try to be positive and constructive. Be it as it may, Nebuchadnezzar was succeeded by a son and by a grandson. And at the time of his grandson's name was Belshazzar. And Belshazzar decided at some point, and I'll tell you why, to make a huge banquet commemorating his father's or his grandfather's victories over the Jews. And the way he wanted to commemorate them and celebrate was to use all of the sacred utensils of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar had plundered from the temple. And he used it to serve food and drink wine. Okay, so this is Belshazzar's banquet. This is in the book of Daniel. And a famous scene happens. This is the scene called the handwriting on the wall, which has entered the English language. In the middle of this drunken banquet, a hand, as it were, comes out of the sky and inscribes in a mysterious writing that nobody could decipher. It happens to be the Hebrew writing, but nobody there could decipher it. And Daniel is able to decipher it. And the message is, these are Aramaic words, it's Hebrew letters, Aramaic words, Mene, Mene, Tikal, Uparsin. Mene, Mene means your deeds have been counted over and over again. Tikal, they have been weighed. Uparsin, and your kingdom will be given to the Persians. Meaning God said, the Babylonian Empire shall disintegrate. And indeed, quite amazingly, it disintegrated with virtually no deaths at all, other than Belshazzar itself, because it mentions that night there was a bloodless coup in which Darius the Mede, Media and Persia were sister states, so to speak, Darius the Mede had Belshazzar assassinated. And other than that one casualty, apparently Belshazzar was not too popular, the Persian Empire just took over the Babylonian Empire.
Is that story about the dinner party, written or discussed anywhere else other than outside of Jewish tradition?
I'm not directly aware of it. I could try to check on this, but this is chapter 5 of the book of Daniel. So this is in the Bible. This is not a rabbinic story. This is actually in the Bible itself. And that expression, handwriting on the wall, has entered the English language, that when something ominous is going to happen, it's like, I've seen the handwriting on the wall. It's taken from that particular story. So, at this point, therefore, we move from Babylon. I mean, Jews are still living in Babylon. It's not that they moved necessarily. But we moved from Babylon to Persia, which is, you know, modern-day Iran. And now the Jewish people are ruled by Persian kings. Now, the first Persian king is Darius the Mede. Daryavish, we call him, right? Daryavish Hamadai. Daryavish is succeeded by a very, very famous king of the ancient world, and that is Cyrus, who is known as Cyrus the Great. And in Hebrew, the name for Cyrus is Koresh. Koresh fancied himself a great humanitarian, and Koresh issued a proclamation to the Jewish people, giving them permission to return to the land of Israel, to rebuild the temple, and Cyrus even agreed to finance its construction. Of course, the way he financed the construction, it's not that it came out of his pocket. He basically levied taxes on the surrounding population to pay the Jews. So he wasn't, he didn't write the check, but he decreed essentially that there be public support of it. Okay, this is the proclamation of Cyrus the Great, right? Cyrus Koresh. Now, this was, just to give you again the timetable, this was 52 years after the destruction of the temple.
It's a short period.
Yeah, so the Jews were in exile officially for 52 years. But the important thing to know is most Jews did not respond to Cyrus's call. A relatively small number responded, and in fact, in the book of Ezra, we're actually given the number. Around 42,000 Jews responded. Less than 50,000. I remember the exact number. Less than 50,000 Jews, which would be approximately, people estimate, we're not given exactly, around maybe 20% or less maybe even 10%, depending on of the population at the time. Okay, that's very, very significant. Even when Cyrus gave us permission to return and rebuild the temple, the vast majority of Jews, even after 50 years already, which is a generation, were comfortable in the diaspora and they preferred to stay. Now that has some obvious analogies to today, where, you know, it's pretty easy to come to Israel and live in Israel. It's not as hard as it was then. But you have to understand then, that the land was totally devastated and destroyed. In fact, you had to be a real pioneer. If you came back to Israel then, we're given descriptions of it. You're coming back to a land in which everything was destroyed. I mean, imagine if you've seen these pictures of Warsaw, Poland, or Berlin, or after World War II. It's just total devastation. Or, you know, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, whatever it would be. I mean, that's what it was like. To come back to Israel then, in other words, we can't even criticize maybe the people who didn't come back. Because they already had a relatively comfortable life. And they were coming back to total devastation. And yet, those 42,000 are very heroic figures. And that is why we're even given their names. Now we're not given the name of every individual, but we're given the name of every family. There actually is a listing. It says, this family had 250 members, and this family had 500 members, and this family had 1,000 members. And when you read it, it's pretty tedious because, gee, I have to, how am I supposed to read this? It's just, you're reading a census list or a telephone book. It's not the most interesting reading. But you have to understand that this is really a great, great honor that those families were entered for posterity as the first families who returned to the land of Israel to build it up. And therefore, there was a decision made to memorialize them permanently. So, you know, you might not consider it interesting, but if you're a descendant of those families, of course, we can't really trace it, you'd be mighty happy to see that, you know, your family is inscribed in there. Okay. By the way, Cyrus was, of course, a non-Jewish king, and he was the one that gave us permission to come back to the land of Israel. And God even refers to Cyrus as a form of Mashiach, Messiah, because he was the one that was God's tool to allow us to come back. So, you know, when the state of Israel was recognized by the United Nations, or was in 1948, so the very first country, or even before the UN, the very first country that recognized the state of Israel happened to be the Soviet Union. And that's really... It's not entirely clear why they did it, but they did. But the second country was the United States, and Harry Truman was the president then. And Harry Truman, although he had some personal anti-Semitic issues just because of cultural issues in Missouri and the like, but his closest friend was a Jewish man. They had a men's clothing store that went bankrupt during the Depression. But Eddie Jacobson was his great buddy. And... although, again, as I say, even though this was his closest friend, Eddie Jacobson never set foot into Truman's house because Truman's wife didn't allow Jews to come into the house. You know, it was a crazy kind of cultural thing. Your best friend is a Jew, but, you know, you can't bring a Jew into your house. Okay, be it as it may, though, Truman was getting advice from the State Department that he should not recognize Israel because it would antagonize the Arab nations, and the Arab nations control the flow of oil. Again, very similar to the State Department attitudes now. Yeah. So Truman was not going to recognize the state of Israel. You know, Truman, after all, wasn't even elected president then. Truman had, you know, he had taken over. Franklin Roosevelt died. Truman had to end World War II. You know, so he didn't want another problem, so to speak. But he felt strongly biblically that the Jews should have a country, but he didn't want to create problems. So Jacobson went to visit him. And he didn't want to see Jacobson because he knew that Jacobson would, you know, argue with him in a way that nobody else could. But finally, Jacobson got in, and Jacobson convinced him to recognize Israel. And Truman was told by a number of rabbis that you are the new Cyrus. You are like Cyrus the Great. You are God's chosen non-Jewish emissary to bring the Jewish people back to their lands. And Truman, who was a student of history and the Bible, was very, very moved by this accolade. And for the rest of his life, he was honored a lot at Jewish banquets. Whenever they talked about his role in the State of Israel, and they didn't mention Cyrus, he would always pull on the coat of the MC and say, hey, you forgot to say I'm Cyrus. know, he just loved, he was really taken with that idea of Cyrus the Great. Now, it's interesting that what was Cyrus's motivation is actually very, very interesting. Was Cyrus' motivation to benefit the Jewish people? So apparently, in the Israel Museum, it's interesting that apparently Cyrus issued these proclamations to a number of nations. It wasn't so Jewish-specific, but Cyrus felt he could consolidate his empire.
You mean like rebuild your land?
Right. He felt that he reversed, in other words, the Sancheirov of Nebuchadnezzar policy of transposing populations. And he felt he could achieve greater stability and even economic prosperity by bringing people back. So it's not necessarily the case that he loved the Jewish people, but this was part of his general policy, which happened to benefit us greatly. But once again, I do want to emphasize that a majority of Jews did not show up. Now, what then happened was, though, of the small group that did show up, they they began to lay the foundations of the temple. But it got stopped because Cyrus was misinformed by various adversaries of the Jews that the temple would be a rebellion point. So although Cyrus allowed the Jews to stay, he issued a royal proclamation stopping the construction of the temple. And that was for another 18 years. And again, you'll see why the 52 and the 18 is significant, because there was a prophecy in Jeremiah that the exile would last 70 years. And this is really where you get that. Okay? Now, I'm going to have to elaborate on this on Sunday a little bit, but let me just say that Koresh was succeeded, according to our tradition, by this fellow called Ahasuerus. So, the Purim story occurs in the tail end of what's called the Babylonian exile, at a time when the temple was already destroyed, but the Jews were permitted to return to the land of Israel. Okay? And they had begun construction of the temple, but it had been terminated. And therefore, Ahasuerosh is king at a time when most of the Jews are living in the diaspora. Some of the Jews might be living in Israel. The construction of the temple had begun, but the construction of the temple had been terminated. Now, to add some spice to this, the so-called enemies who slandered the Jews and therefore got Cyrus to withdraw the construction of the temple are not identified in the Bible, but rabbinic tradition says they were none other than the 10 sons of Haman. That the 10 sons of Haman, who wound up being hung in the Megillah later, were the ones who convinced the king to withdraw permission for the construction of the temple. So even before Haman is on the scene here, his adult sons had already created that difficulty. Okay, so that is the historical background. Now, we'll see next time that Ahasuerus makes a party as well, and according to rabbinic tradition, his party is very much like Belshazzar's party. He's celebrating with the utensils of the temple. But in the Purim story, we don't have handwriting on the wall. And that's kind of the idea that in Megillas Esther, there are no supernatural miracles. In Megillas Esther, God operates through veils and concealment. Right? It's a very different orientation. This is not the God of open and obvious miracle, but this is the God who functions within normal everyday reality to bring about desired results. So it's very interesting that you start off with something very parallel to Daniel chapter 5, but the story proceeds along a very, very different line. Okay? Okay, we'll see you on Sunday.
Shabbos.
Shabbos.